All right. So I'm going to say a little bit about myself here. Here's the thing. When they asked me to come, I was really, really excited. And they were like, so what do you – I was talking to Teresa Schmitz, actually. She's the one that contacted me first. And she was like, well, what do you want to talk about? And I'm like, who doesn't want to talk about themselves? Because I'm so awesome. Which is completely untrue. But the reason why I like to give my testimony is a couple reasons. One, because I really, again, working with teenagers like literally every day of my life for the last 26 years, it's been hard for me to forget what it's like to be a teenager, okay? And so I remember very clearly what it's like when I was your age and I was sitting on retreats and things. And I know that some of you are here for the first time. Some of you have been here for like maybe even more years than my family's been coming, right? You've been coming since you were in a crib or something, right? Some of you are here because you were made to be here. Like, your mom and dad were just like, we're being Catholic all of a sudden, and we're going to this thing, and you're going to love it, okay? Or you're going to die, right? And you're just like, okay, so I'm here. I don't know exactly why you're here, but I know that even if you've been coming for years and years and years, it's still good to hear just how God it awesomely works in people's lives, right? We read about these stories in Scripture of like, you know, wow, Jesus did all these miracles back then. Jesus is still doing miracles today, right? He's still doing miracles today. And I'm totally going off the rails right now. That's okay. I'll just talk fast later. But I want to tell you how I know that, right? Because I've seen it. Just this weekend, I was in Houston all weekend. I don't know if there's anybody from the great state of Texas with us. All right, great. Awesome. You are? Okay. You guys from Texas? Okay, cool. Where are you from in Texas? Dallas. Okay, so you hate Houston. Okay, got it. All right, so Dallas and Houston have this like love-hate relationship. And Houston's really weird because like they named their team the Texans. Like, that's like the Pittsburgh Pennsylvanians. That sounds so stupid. But anyway, but I was in Houston for a few days, and it was really cool. I was doing these retreats. And when I got there, I met some of the other team members who I'd not met before. And they came in. It was like Thursday night, and we were kind of chatting a little bit. And they had talked about how they had gotten in earlier in the day, and they just went to downtown Houston. And started doing like street evangelization. And they were like, yeah, so that's really cool. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. And they put it on Facebook or Instagram or other social media in order to like help people like, you know, pray for them or whatever. And the one guy that I met ends up finding out that he goes to Franciscan University with my oldest daughter who just graduated from there. And he actually knows her, right? And he's like, oh, how is Mary Kate doing? I said, good. And my oldest son just graduated high school, and he's going to Franciscan in the fall as well. I have another daughter there too. So he knew that my oldest daughter, Mary Kate, and my son, John Paul, my oldest son, are right now in Europe walking the Camino, which is this 500-mile pilgrimage across northern Spain. So right now they're doing that. They're like 4 days into that. And he said, oh, how is her ankle? Because she has like ankle problems. And I said, oh, actually she put it in Lourdes. They stopped at Lourdes first. She put it in the baths at Lourdes. And she thinks that it's pretty much healed because the first day they walked 17 miles over the Pyrenees. These mountains, and she had no swelling, no pain whatsoever. And he was like, oh, that's awesome. I said, yeah, unfortunately, she gets her bad ankles from me. And I showed him my ankle brace, and they all looked at each other like, whoa. And I was like, that's weird. What's whoa? And they're like, okay, when we posted we were doing sidewalk ministry today, this girl that knows the one guy, right? She texted him from wherever she is across the country. And she was like, as soon as I started praying for you, I got this image of like a middle-aged guy with a hurt ankle somewhere in the number 5. That's all I know. Like, I don't know what that means. I don't know if it's 5th Street or whatever. And they're like, dude, we just showed up here at the church and you're a middle-aged guy. I'm like, thank you very much for that. You're like a middle-aged guy and you have a hurt ankle. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, you know the name of the street that the church is on? 5th Street. Right? So like they prayed over it, and then he sent a picture to the girl saying, we met the guy that God told you about. And she wrote back and said, I just prayed again, and God said to ask about how his daughter is doing. Like, this is like, this stuff like happens, right? So I want to get into the story. Next slide there. And I'm going to start right from the very beginning. I'm not going to start right at the very beginning because that would be awkward, but I'm going to start a few months into the beginning, okay? Thank you for getting that joke, Grace. I appreciate it, okay? All right, so I was born in 1971, and I'm telling you, I was an objectively cute baby. I think we can all agree on that, okay? Everybody thinks their baby's the cutest baby in the world, and a lot of times a mom shows you a baby, she's like, isn't my baby the cutest baby ever? And a lot of times you're like, yes. And sometimes you're thinking, kind of looks like E.T., actually, but... Babies are all cute. They're not all objectively beautiful, okay? But I think I was, all right? Now, I don't show you this picture just because it's objectively cute. I show you this picture because it's actually a miracle picture, okay? When my mom was pregnant with me in 1970, there was this anti-nausea drug that had been developed that they gave to women in the late 60s and early 70s. And I don't remember the name of it because it's a big, long scientific name and it doesn't really matter. In fact, I don't know if you ever met or heard of Tony Melendez. He's a Catholic singer. He plays the guitar with his feet because he has no arms. He's played before the Pope. You might have seen him. You can like YouTube him. He's awesome. I've spoken to some events with him and like gotten to actually like pray over him and stuff, and it's just so cool. His mom took the same medicine, right? The problem with that medicine is that it started causing all these birth defects in babies when they were born, right? While they were developing this drug, while it was stopping some of the morning sickness for the moms, it was hurting the babies, okay? And my mom took this medicine. They didn't know at the time, right, that it was hurting the babies. They found that out afterwards, and then that drug was taken off the market. Right. So when I was born on January 20th, 1971, I came out 8 pounds. Everything sounds, you know, and looks good. I got all my fingers on my feet, on my toes. Everything looks fine. Between day one and day two, I lost 50% of my birth weight. I went from 8 pounds to 4 pounds, and I kept spitting and throwing everything up that they tried to feed me, right? My mom tried feeding me. It wouldn't work. They tried giving me formula. It wouldn't work. I kept spitting it up. So the second day of my life, the doctors are like really concerned. They're like, we got to do some medical tests. And obviously the testing they did then and the medicine they had then is way less advanced than it is now. And they came back to my parents at the second day of my life and they said, okay, we did the test and we have some bad news. Your son was born with a birth defect. And my mom was like, what? We don't see anything. And they said, it's internal. She was like, what is it? And he said, well, what happens is that your son's small intestine was born with a knot in it. And so he's not going to be able to digest and process any food, and he's going to starve to death, right? And, you know, this was devastating. This is my mom and dad's first child. My mom's the oldest at 9. It was the first grandchild. It was, you know, on her family side, it was like, you know, the first little nephew for all her brothers and sisters, you know. And so everybody's like really upset. And they said, well, you know, they said, is there nothing you can do? And they said, well, there's a very risky surgery that we can try that we've just started. And this surgery, what we're going to do is we're going to cut your son open from his belly button to his side. And we're going to literally pull out his small intestine. Find the knot. We're going to cut the knot out of the small intestine, and we're going to sew the two pieces back together, and we're going to hope that it stays where it's supposed to stay. And my parents said, okay, then whatever you need to do, do it. So they scheduled surgery for the next morning. They told my parents, I said, we do have to warn you, however, that it's a very risky surgery, and we are estimating that your son only has a 5% chance of living. So when I was 2 days old, I was given a 5% chance of living. Let's put that in perspective. That means a 95% chance of dying. I just flew from Houston to Baltimore yesterday to come home before I drove here. If I was sitting there in the gate area and the gate agent gone, I was like,
ladies and gentlemen, welcome to flight 777 to Baltimore, Washington International. This flight has a 95% chance of crashing. Welcome aboard.
No one's getting on that plane, right? I'll be like, I'll wait for the one that has a 95% chance of getting there, not 95% chance of crashing, right? So I had this surgery, and it was very scary, and obviously I lived. I actually still have the scar to this day that goes from here to here across my stomach. I'm not going to show it to you because then you'd be scarred, okay? But you just have to trust me. It's there, okay? All right, so let's go to the next slide because here's the question, right? Why were you created? Like, I always knew when I was growing up as a kid, like, there must be a reason why God had me here because I should have died when I was 3 days old. Like, it defied all odds. I shouldn't be here. Like, that picture that I just showed of me as a baby is a miracle picture because I was taken when I was about 8 months old. And that picture never should have been taken, right? I should have been gone. In fact, my mom always tells a story that during the 2 months that I was in the hospital, there was two other babies that were born with the same birth defect as me. Both of them had the same surgery and both of them died. So I always knew growing up that I there must be a reason why I'm here, right? And so I think the first place we need to start off, I titled this talk, you know, like, who am I? And I don't mean for you to be finding out just like, who am I? I want you to be asking that question for yourself. I think when you're a young person, you start saying like, who am I? Like, why am I here? You know, the Catechism of the Catholic Church has, you can click the next slide there, 2,865 paragraphs, okay? And there's a lot of people that know a lot about the catechism, right? You can ask people, and depending on what they're teaching or what they're studying, you know, they know big sections of the catechism. And very few people have read the whole thing cover to cover. It's really not a storybook, right? I mean, it's a reference book. But it tells you everything that you want to know about what the church teaches, right? It's about like this thick, if you haven't seen one. 2,865 paragraphs. But I tell people, do you know what the first paragraph says? Normally people are like, no, what does the first paragraph say? I'm like, we should all know as Catholics what the first paragraph of the catechism says, right? Because if you like to read like I do, the first paragraph of a book normally tells you something really important. It sets a stage. It sets a scene. It introduces you to a character. It's when the murder's committed. I mean, right? I mean, like, that's the big important thing. So the next two slides are going to be the two parts of this first paragraph. And I want you to look at this with me. Go to the next one. Okay, paragraph number one. Here we go. God, infinitely perfect and blessed in himself, in a plan of sheer goodness, freely created man to make him share in his own blessed life. I want to break this down for a minute before I go to the next one. God, infinitely perfect and blessed in himself. Stop. What does that mean? What that means is that God does not need you, and God does not need me, right? God is infinitely perfect and blessed in himself. God did not create us because he was bored, right? Like, he's sitting at dinner one night and he's like, you know, Dad, this is Jesus speaking. You know, Dad, I love you and our dinner conversation, but I'm getting a little bored, right? I need some entertainment. We haven't invented Netflix yet. Let's make some people, right? Like, God did not do that. God did not do that because he wanted to like play games and just create us and then sit back and watch us. And like, ooh, look at them. Well, that's pretty stupid. that's not going to end well. I mean, right? God didn't do that. God was infinitely perfect and blessed in himself. So why would he create us then? Why are we created? In a plan of sheer goodness, he freely created us to make him share in his own blessed life. And what is his own blessed life? God's abundant love. God was perfectly complete in himself, but he was like so love. God is love that he simply wanted to share that outside of himself. Not because he needs it, because he just wanted to. And there's something that is humbling about knowing God doesn't need us, but something spectacular about the fact that he wants us. There's literally nothing more that God, the God of the universe, who created literally every single thing that you see in the sky, on the ground, in the water. There's something spectacular about the fact that he wants nothing more than to love you and have you know that he wants you and to be in your heart and to be your best friend and to be your intimate Savior and Lord. That's all he wants. That's all he's ever wanted, right? What does the next part of this say? So he goes on to say, ding, ding. So for this reason, right, because God freely created us because he didn't need us, he wants us. At every time and in every place, God draws close to man. He calls man to seek him, to know him, to love him with all his strength. At every moment, look at that. God, I was doing a retreat in North Carolina, actually. Yeah, there you go. It was near Belmont Abbey College, right? And there was an awesome priest that did a mass, and we just had the retreat go to the parish mass. And I'm not being disrespectful to this priest because he was really giving an awesome homily. But the whole homily was about how God is up here and we're down here. And he just kept talking about like how awesome God is and how we're so low and God's everything and we're nothing and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yes, that's true. That's true. And I kept waiting for him to say the part though that's spectacular. And he never got to it. And I don't know if he forgot, if he left out of his notes, if he was just trying to make people feel bad. Because I left away from that homily going, Father, without the most important part, all we're left with is God is there and we can never reach him. And that doesn't sound like good news. That sounds hopeless. What he forgot to say was, God is up there and we're down here and we can't reach him. So he came down to reach us. That's the good news. And so this doesn't say, for this reason, every time and every place, man draws close to God. It says God draws close to man. That is such an important distinction for us to know. And then he calls us. He invites us. He knocks on the door of our hearts and he says, seek me. And we're all seeking him. I don't know how close you feel to God right now or how close you are, but every single one of us in here is seeking God, whether we know it or not. Every human in the world is seeking God, right? And then he wants us to know him, not just know about him. That's a really big distinction that we need to know as Catholics, that we can sit here and know all about Jesus up here and we never let it move down here. We end up going through life having near faith experiences, right? You know what that is? You know what a near-death experience is? Like, you almost died? There's so many Catholics that are walking around almost having faith. You know, they go to youth conferences, they go on retreats like this, and they watch other people open their hearts, and they see other people experiencing God in adoration at Mass. They see other people having these faith experiences, but they don't. And they're like, yeah, that's not really for me. I'm glad you're having it. No, Jesus wants you to know him. But he's not going to force his way into your heart. He's going to call. He's going to knock. He's going to beg. He'll annoy you. He will bug you. But he's not going to break down the door of your heart if you keep it closed and the door locked. But he wants to know you, and he wants you to know him, not just know about him, right? We need to have things move from here to here in our lives. You want to know why? Because when we grow up Catholic, it's so awesome. We learn so much about Jesus, don't we? It's awesome. We have the catechism. We have these curriculums. We have these classes. We learn so much about Jesus. And we can get up and we can spit all these answers back out. But what happens is that we're a little kid and we learn all this stuff. And we're like, I love Jesus and he loves me. And all the songs and the hand motions are teaching the little kids here this week. And that's awesome. And then you get older into middle school and high school in your guys' age. And life starts hitting you, doesn't it? People get sick. People die. People treat you terrible. Friends betray you. You realize your mom and dad aren't perfect. People hurt you. And all of a sudden, when life starts hitting you, things start hurting. And when life hits you, where does it hit you? Where does it hit you? Point to where it hits you. When life hits you. Thank you. It hits you here, right? So if your faith is only up here, then what happens when life starts hitting you here? See, if you believe in God, when life starts hitting you, there's only two responses. I have no idea what the response is for an atheist who doesn't believe in God. But if you are someone who believes in God even remotely, and life starts hitting you, and there's suffering, and there's tragedy, and there's bad stuff, and there's hurt, and there's pain, you only have two responses. You either blame God, get mad at God, and turn away from God, or you fall deeper into God. And if God is only here, and he's not here, when life hits you here, what do you think you're going to do? Speak to the hand, God. Get out of my face. I grew up and you said you loved me. If you loved me, then why did this happen? How come that happened? That's a really weird kind of love. You know, if everybody loved me the way you love me, then I would be in really bad shape. And we start to believe those lies, right? I grew up knowing Jesus loved me. I knew that there was a reason I was here. All right, next slide. I think until, yep, there we go. Good. I'm trying to keep on track here. About fifth grade. I know, I'm still pretty cute in fifth grade, actually. My hair, I know, is a mess. That was the day I decided to go from a center part to a side part after I got to school on picture day. Didn't have a comb or a brush. I just had this. Okay, didn't work too well. All right. But what happened in fifth grade? When I grew up, I was always the short, skinny kid, right? I was always the shortest kid in my class. I was just short of skinny. I grew up playing soccer. I loved running around. I was like a maniac. There's like home video of me. Like all I'm doing is basically running around like a maniac, okay? I actually kind of like can't stand it when my kids do that. I'm like, I don't know how my parents didn't kill me. But so that's what I did. I was just crazy and wild. And I got to fifth grade. And something happened in fifth grade that kind of changed everything, right? Fifth grade, you're starting to like start to move towards middle school. In fifth grade, I completely stopped growing, okay? And I didn't grow at all. So between fifth grade and eighth grade, I didn't grow. So when I started eighth grade, I was the same height that I was in fifth grade. And I was already short for a fifth grader, right? So you can show the next one. That's a big difference. That's me. In the middle. That's my teacher, right? Sister Roseanne. Those are two of my friends. They're actually the same age as me. Those are not my sponsors or whatever for confirmation. Those are people in my grade. I'm actually older than them, okay? One of the other things that you can see is not only did I not grow, but I also put on weight. But when you go to the doctor growing up, they'd always take your height and your weight. And I was actually the perfect weight for a 14-year-old boy. I was like the 50th percentile for weight, right? The problem was I was the height of a short fifth grader because I completely stopped growing. So what was happening is that I not only didn't grow, I started putting on all this weight. And what happens is I lived in Northern Virginia and grew up in Northern Virginia, a little town called Warrenton. And there was only like either 12 or 16 people in my class at any time. And I don't think people were trying to be mean. I really don't. because we all kind of grew up together and knew each other. But middle school can be so awkward, right? People's bodies are changing and your emotions are there and there's hormones and you don't know what's going on. Some people are like 13 but look like they're 20, and some people are 13 and look like they're 8, you know, and it's so weird. And so I don't think people knew what to do with the fact that like they're all growing and developing and I'm just sitting there looking like I'm still in third grade. And so people started teasing me. And I don't think they're trying to make fun of me, but the problem is what I did is I listened to those voices. And the voices and the things that people said started to go into my ears, and I let them start to go into my heart. And what happens is this little boy who always believed there was a reason he was here, that Jesus loved him, started to hate himself. And by the time I got into eighth grade, I literally hated myself. I don't know if you can see that. Maybe you giggled a little bit when you first saw it. Like, that is like the fakest smile. Like, I am not happy at all. I'm just like, okay, right? This is just terrible, okay? So what they did in eighth grade is they started to do all these tests. You can go to the next one. I'm pretty sure it's the next one. There you go, the Krelbo, okay? So I had to go to Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C., and they were going to give me a five-hour blood test where every 20 and 40 minutes they had to draw blood, okay? So I'm going to tell you this story because it's pretty fascinating. So how many people don't like needles? Raise your hand. Okay, so there is a needle involved in the story, right? So what happened is they wanted to give me an IV. They weren't going to stick me with a new needle every 20 and 40 minutes because that would have been torturous. So they put an IV in. They looked for a vein in my hand or my arm. They couldn't find one. As it turns out, I have like this uber vein like right here. I'm not sure if you can see it from there. You might actually even be able to see a little bit of the shadow. Somebody wants to touch it later, you can. It's kind of cool. It's like a trampoline for your finger. When I'm sitting in an airport and I'm bored, I'm just like, ding, 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 right? All right. So they put the IV in there. I still give blood every couple months, and they always are like, whoa, look at that man's vein. I'm like, I know. It's awesome. It's an uber vein, okay? So they stuck it in there, and this part of the body, ironically enough, does not have an official name. So I made it up. It's called the Krelbo, okay? And I thought elbow pit sounded awkward, so I went with Krelbo. So this is the Krelbo. If you guys can use it as much as possible in daily language, eventually you'll get in the dictionary. I'll give you a sentence you can use it in. Somebody throws you a microphone. You're like, whoa. It's okay. I caught it with my Krelbo. It's all good. It's all good. All right. It didn't break. All right. Don't drop the mic. Catch it with your Krelbo. All right. So they stick the needle into my Krelbo. The nurse tapes it all up. I'm sitting on this hospital bed, you know, and she takes a step back and she looks at her handiwork, right? And she goes, Now, I'm no medical professional, okay? But I'm pretty sure you should get all the hmms out of the way before you stick a needle in my Krelbo, okay? So I was like, what? And she's like, well, now that I've got it in there, I'm realizing it's going to be there for like 5 hours, and I'm a little concerned that at some point in the next 5 hours, you might go like this, and that would really hurt. Plus, it would mess up the test. And I'm like, yeah? And she's like, all right, I got to come up with a solution for that. You hold still, sweetie, and I'll be back in a couple of minutes. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to die. I was a little dramatic back then, okay? So I'm like, okay, all right. So she leaves. She comes back about 10 minutes later. I am not kidding you. She walks into my room, and she is holding a 2x4, okay? Now, if you don't know what a 2x4, it's these little pieces of wood over here that they built this wall with, okay? You can see it on your way out. It's a piece of wood that's 2x4. And this was about this long, and she goes into the bathroom, and I'm like, what is she doing with that 2x4? She comes out with her towel wrapped around the 2x4, and she comes over with a roll of tape. And I'm getting concerned, okay? And she takes the 2x4 and she sticks my arm on it and she tapes my arm to the 2x4. Now, my first question that's going through my mind is, where the heck did she get a 2x4 from at a children's hospital? Like, is this even sanitary? You know, like, did she go to the nurse's station and be like,
maintenance, this is Susie on the fourth floor. I need a 2x4 stack.
Is some guy like dumpster diving in the back of the thing trying to find me? Like, I don't know. I'm like worried about this. So they stick this 2x4 under my arm. She tapes it to my arm and she's like, well, there we go. Now we're all set. And I'm like, okay, now you might think, Scott, you big wimp, right? Like if you stuck your arm out like this right now, like it'd be like, that doesn't hurt. Okay. Yeah. Do it for 5 hours, okay? Your arm was not intended to be like this for 5 hours, or God would not have invented the elbow, okay? That's why he invented the elbow, okay? Anyone ever played sports and you're running down the field or whatever and you get that Charlie horse right there in your calf? Anybody had that happen, right? You run down, you're just like, ah! Right, and you fall on the ground, you're writhing, and then someone comes and saves the day by like laying you on your back and bending your knee back and your foot back and give you that special leg. And then you're like, oh, that's magically delicious, right? And all of a sudden, like, it cures it somehow, and you're like, oh, I didn't know that word. Well, you can't do that like magically delicious move on your arm when it's taped to a 2x4, okay? So it actually was pretty painful. I remember, like, there was times that I was like crying, I was getting Charlie horses, the muscles were throbbing and contracting. I couldn't do anything about it. I just had to push through it. That wasn't even the worst part. She gets done putting that up. She takes a step back and she goes, oh, by the way. Again, no medical professional here, but I'm pretty sure we should get all the oh by the ways out of the way before you tape my arm to a 2x4, right? I said, oh, by the way, what? She says, see this big machine next to the bed? I looked to the big machine next to the bed. I said, yes, I see the machine next to the bed. Why? She said, you're hooked up to it. Okay, what does that mean? She goes, well, basically, there's going to be certain dyes and chemicals we need to put into your bloodstream before we take the blood, and this will do that automatically. We also need your heart at a resting rate for most of these blood tests. So what we need you to do is basically lay as still as possible in this bed for the next 5 hours. And I was like, Now, that might not sound that bad, right? You know, but when you're a guy and you're 13, like most of the plane of your existence has lived somewhere around here. Okay? Like, so true, right? I know. So I'm like, this is like, I'm pretty sure I got time off purgatory sitting in that bed for 5 hours, okay? But you know what? Not even that was the worst part. About 2.5 hours in, the worst thing ever. Can anybody guess? Worst thing that happened? I had to pee. I heard it right there. I had to pee. Now, my mom was with me. My mom's a nurse, but she wasn't my nurse. So I said, Mom, could you, like, get the nurse real quick for me? And she was like, sure. So she goes to ring the little bell for the nurse, and she goes, well, honey, is there something I can help you with? She's probably busy. I said, I don't think so, Mom. I need this to be unhooked so I can just jump down. I'm going to go right there into the bathroom. I'm going to pee. I'll jump back in the bed, and then she can hook me back up. And my mom stopped, and she looked at me, and she said, sweetie, they're not going to unhook you. And I said, ha, 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 deaf woman, that is funny. I have to pee. And she's like, I heard you. They're not going to unhook you. I said, then how am I supposed to pee? And she said, well, there's a little bowl called a bedpan. And we will just come over and place it on the bed and you will lay on your side and you'll pee into the bowl and then we'll go flush it for you. Now, the girls might not understand the next obvious question that came to my mind because I'm right-handed. Now the light bulbs are going off. I looked at my mom and I said the next obvious question, which was, Mom, great idea, except how am I supposed to hold the bowl and aim with one hand? My mom looked at me and she said, sweetie, I'll hold the bowl. How many of you want to go home tonight to your little cramped cabin and pee into a bowl while your mommy holds it, okay? I don't think so. If you're like, yeah, that sounds awesome, you need therapy, okay? Like, no, you don't want to pee in a bowl while your mom holds it, especially when you're 14 years old, right? You're just like, no. I'm like, that's not happening. There's got to be another option. She said, because I'm starting to panic now, right? She's like, the nurse can do it. I'm like, I'm not peeing in a bowl while someone holds it, okay? She's like, there's no other option. I said, okay, you know what? Fine. Mind over matter. I don't have to go. I can make it the next 2.5 hours. My mom looked at the IV dripping in. She said, good luck with that. And I did. I held it. And I'm here 35 years later, I guess, to say that I'm pretty proud of that fact, that I held it for 40 more minutes. No, stop. It was only 40 more minutes. And then I had to pee so bad, I'm pretty sure it was starting to seep out the pores of my face. And I was like, fine, okay, I have two choices here. Both are embarrassing. But one is I pee in a bowl that someone holds, or I pee all over myself in the bed. That sounds worse. So I was like, all right, fine, get the nurse. So my mom gets a nurse. She comes in. She's taking her time. At this point, once you're ready to go, you're just like, fine, it's embarrassing. I don't care. Then you just want it over with as quick as possible. And she's like taking 10 minutes to put on the gloves and whatever. So she finally comes over and she holds the bowl there. And I am not kidding or exaggerating. This is what she does and says. She puts the bowl there and then she goes like this. Don't worry, sweetie. I do this all the time. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. Just let it go, you know. And I'm like, ma'am, if you don't hold that bowl still, okay, we are going to have a big mess on our hands because I can barely hit a stationary target, let alone one that's moving, okay? I'm serious. Like, girls, you don't understand the dilemma. Like, God made you. You sit. It goes where it's supposed to go. Guys, we walk up sometimes. We're like, whoa, how'd that happen? It's like things just, I don't know. I don't get it, right? People are like, that's so true. Some people are just like, oh, this has turned really, that's too far. Too far. It's crossed the line. Okay. All right, so I had all these tests. So here's what they do. They come back to me at the end of eighth grade, and they say, well, we have some bad news and some good news. The bad news is that you have another birth defect. okay? And it's another internal birth defect. We all have this gland on the back underside of our brain, and I only know it's there because I had to do these, like, ninja moves in an MRI tunnel in order for them to see it. But it's the master gland of our body. It's called the pituitary gland. Maybe some of you have heard of that, okay? Maybe that's your friend. It wasn't my friend. Okay, my pituitary gland basically controls all your hormones, all your chemicals. They sat me down. They said, yours doesn't work. I said, what does that mean? They said, in and of itself, what it means is not only are you never going to grow again, you're not even going to go through puberty. Now, there's a lot of things that a 14-year-old boy does not want to hear. I can tell you from personal experience, at the top of the list is, you're going to be a man-child for the rest of your life. All right? That's basically what I heard. So I can laugh about it now, praise God. But at the time, I started crying. I was like, great, my life is over. This is going to be terrible. I'm going to be 4'7". Is how tall I was. You know how tall 4'7 is? If I was standing here today next to me, it would be about here, right? So I'm 4'7", and they're telling me you're not going to grow up, basically. And so I was crying. They said, no, there's good news. You can take something called growth hormone shots. And I was like shots? And they're like, no, you're 14, you weirdo. No, we mean shots. And here we are back to needles, right? So 3 times a week for all 4 years of high school, I had to take growth hormone shots, right? And at first, my mom would give them to me, right, in my thigh. And then I learned to give them to myself. They switched the needle. The first year and a half, the needle was this long. I am not exaggerating. Then they switched to an insulin syringe, so the needle was smaller. I learned to give it to myself. I'd have friends over, you know, like junior high school or whatever, be like, hey, want to see something? And they're like, what are you doing? And I'm like, and they're like, is that a needle? I'm like, and they're like, oh my gosh. And then I'd sit there and I'd go, and like, does that hurt? And I'd be like, hurt? No, it doesn't hurt. Because I was a complete moron when I was your age, okay? So the thing is that I go into ninth grade. Now, I'm going to take the shot starting in ninth grade. But a lot of things happened before then. My parents, I'm still in Northern Virginia. My parents wanted me to go to a Catholic high school. At the time, the closest Catholic high school was an hour and a half away. I had to get on the bus at 5:45 every morning, and sometimes 2 hours of traffic. I had to drive to the school on the bus, got to school, didn't get home till 5:15 every night, couldn't be involved in any activities because the school was so far away, right? So I get into ninth grade, and ninth grade was literally the worst year of my life. I went from people who were teasing me to people who were literally abusive. We stopped halfway between Warrenton and Fairfax in Manassas to pick up another group of students with a bus, and there was a kid starting in October that every day of the rest of freshman year, when he got on the bus, he would walk up and down the aisle until he found me. And trust me, I would try to hide. And he would look until he found me, and he would punch me as hard as he could. I got punched in the face, the head, the back, the shoulder, the legs, the arm. He punched me as hard as he could, and he'd say, I hate your guts. Good morning. And he'd go have a seat. And when I told on him, it got worse, right? Because we know that happens sometimes. So I want you to go to this next clip, right? This is me in high school. I'm the one on the far right. These are my two younger brothers. Okay. Now, this picture tells a lot of things. One, I like that the bricks are behind us so you can see like a line of where the height is, right? My brother Brian, who's on the far left side of this picture, is in sixth grade in this picture. I'm in ninth grade. My brother Chris, and Brian is obviously much taller than me. Chris comes up to my eyebrows. Chris in the middle is in third grade in this picture. I'm in ninth grade. You can see something else about this picture. The two of them are just like, yay, we're getting our picture taken. And my face is like, if we don't hurry up with this, I'm going to kill, right? Like, I am not a happy person. And look at my body language. I'm like hiding, trying to hide behind my brother. I'm putting my arm across my stomach. You know, I went from like hating myself in eighth grade to at the end of ninth grade, here's what happened to me. It's not that I stopped believing in God. In some ways, I think where I got in my faith was even worse than not believing in God. I believed there was a God. I just didn't believe he loved me, right? I believe that God was too busy for Scott Anthony. God had too much going on in his universe. And I was completely miserable. I remember the night before the spring semester started, we had like 2 weeks off for Christmas. And I remember literally sobbing and screaming and begging my parents, don't send me back to this school. Don't send me back tomorrow. I can't keep doing this. And they said, we don't have another option. There was no homeschooling at the time. And there was only a big, giant public school that was like 3,000 students. And my parents were like, if you can't handle 1,400 students, you're not going to be able to handle 3,000 students. They knew I would have been even worse at the public school where I was at. And so I went through this ninth grade. And then the end of ninth grade, my parents decided that we were going to move from, you can go to the next one, we were going to move from Warrenton, Virginia, to a little town on the Ohio River about 20 minutes from here called Steubenville, Ohio. And so we moved to Steubenville, Ohio. And I started school at Catholic Central High School in Steubenville, Ohio. And when I moved that summer, a couple of things happened. One, I grew. I grew that first year. The shots worked. I didn't grow a lot as far as like me getting super tall, but I grew from 4'7 to 5'1 in 1 year, which is a huge difference. And as I grew, my weight stayed the same, and so I thinned out. So I knew going into this new school, nobody knows me. I'm back to being the kind of short, skinny kid, right? I can be whatever I want to be. And the only thing that I wanted to be was not sad. I wanted to be happy. And I had said to God, you know what? You're too busy for me. So I thought, I need to make myself happy. What do I need to do? I made a pact to myself that summer that I was going to do whatever it took, that by senior year of high school, everybody in that school was going to know who Scott Anthony is. And I was going to be one of the most popular kids in my school. And every day from day one, that's what I did. Day one, I got up, I put on my shoes, I put on my pants, I put on my shirt, I put on my backpack, and I put on my first mask. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about because you still do it. You get up every day, and right before you walk out your door, you put on your mask. And what you let people see out here is very, very different than what you let people see in here. This is completely different, right? And that's what I did for 3 years, right? And it was exhausting. It was exhausting. I'm going to ask you to go through two slides because I don't have time to tell that one. But if you want to hear that later, you'll have to come to me. But that's called the Spanish story. It's just an example of what a idiot I was. But you know, what I did was, is I became the class clown. I was not very good at school because I didn't like myself. And I started doing bad in math in middle school. So I decided I'm dumb. I'm stupid. So I stopped trying in school. So I got bad grades. I just fooled around. I'm sure my teachers hated me because all I did was try to make everybody laugh all the time. And I threw myself into activities. I tried out for the soccer team. I made the soccer team. I was a starting left midfielder by senior year, right? I was in all the plays and musicals. I got leads. I wrote for the newspaper and the yearbook because I could make people look good or I could make people look bad. So they all wanted to be my friends, right? And I just threw myself into this, right? And I go through and I grew. This is actually my friend Lynn. Her family and our family were friends down in Virginia. When we moved to Ohio, they moved to New Jersey, right? And their family stayed friends with us. And then when I graduated from high school, you know, she came up. I show this picture for two reasons. One, I show it because, honestly, it's one of the first pictures that I have of me in high school. You saw the picture in eighth grade. You saw the picture in ninth grade. I don't have a lot of pictures of me in high school where I'm smiling. And the ones that I am, I'm like, it's a complete fake smile. I look at it now and I'm like, that was so funny. I'm actually really smiling in this picture. I'm smiling and I'm happy. Go to the next slide for just a second. We might go back. But I was voted the best actor of my class, right? Thank you. I know. You're clapping because I was hot too, but I know. But you know what? Here's the thing. It was crazy. I mean, I look at my senior picture though. And by senior year, I had achieved everything I wanted to achieve. I was one of the most popular people in my school. I was successful in sports. I was successful in acting. I had tons of friends. I was hanging out all the time. I don't want you to get the wrong impression, though. I really didn't get into a lot of the big bad stuff that everybody gets into. You know, I had a girlfriend. I was a virgin when I got married. I didn't get into drugs and alcohol. I went to a lot of parties, but I didn't drink. I didn't try drugs. Honestly, I'm 47 years old. I don't even know what marijuana smells like, okay? I didn't do all this big, bad stuff. I would go to parties because people wanted me to stand on a table and make everybody laugh for an hour. So I would do that. I would do dumb, stupid, crazy stuff to make people laugh. But I look at this picture of myself beginning of senior year, and I don't see anyone who's happy. Look at my eyes. I'm not even smiling in my senior picture. Like, this is what is in my yearbook for my senior year. My eyes are as dark in this picture as they are in my ninth grade picture. Because let me tell you what happened. I achieved all those things, and guys, there's nothing more miserable than thinking I just need to achieve this and this and this and this, and then I'll be satisfied. Then I'll be happy. Then I'll be fulfilled. And yet you work so hard. You put on those masks every day. It's exhausting. You everything to everyone so that they'll like you. And then at the end of the day, you don't like yourself. I turned 18 in the middle of that senior year. And by that time, I was literally crying myself to sleep every night because I didn't know who I was anymore. I didn't do all these big, giant, bad sins. What I did is at the end of ninth grade, I just started walking away from God. I didn't run away. I didn't take big, giant leaps away. I just took little steps. And I just took little steps and little steps and little steps. And if you can go back one slide to that other one here, the reason that I also show this picture is not only to show that I'm happy, also to show that look how much I grew between 8th grade and 12th grade because I'm now the same height. Actually, I'm bent over. I'm a little bit taller than Lynn in that picture. But that's the second miracle picture that I'm showing you today in my story. That picture was taken in the last weekend of May in 1989, just a couple miles from here, okay? 1 month before this picture was taken, the last weekend of April 1989, I tried to commit suicide. I had just gotten to the point where I said, you know what? The world would be better off without Scott Anthony in it. What's the point? I'm exhausted. Yeah, I'm having fun. Yeah, I have all these friends. Yeah, I'm doing all this stuff. But you know what? I am living with so many masks. It wasn't just one mask. It was like, literally, I'd have a mask on when I was at home, another one when I was with my soccer team, another one when I was with my girlfriend, another one when I was at, you know, the thespians, you know, with the acting, another one when I was with my youth group that my parents made me go to. I mean, I just play acted. When I was voted the best actor of my class, no one had any idea that I was the best actor in my class because what everybody saw out here was completely different than what was going on in here. Nobody knew I cried myself to sleep every night. I didn't talk to my best friend about any of this. I didn't talk to my girlfriend. I certainly didn't talk to my parents. I lived in this isolation, darkness all by myself because I walked away from God. And that's exactly where Satan wants us. He wants us to walk into those dark places where he can isolate us and he can start to whisper lies into our hearts. And because we have taken God out of our heart and we open that door of pain, Satan walks right in, right? You go to the one with the best actor again real quick, okay, before we go to the next one. And so I got to this dark time. I got to this dark time. And I'm not going to go into the details of it. When it happened, I was like, I don't think I'm ever going to tell anybody about this. And then God has a sense of humor and he tricked me into youth ministry. And I've been telling the story ever since, right? But not because I'm so awesome, but because God's so awesome, right? The reality is this, and this is when I start to wind down here. You know, some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. Some of you have been in that dark place. Some of you in this room right now, I know, like, you're like, dude, we are so early in the week. I thought we went deep on Thursday night. No, we're going deep now. Some of you are in that dark place right now. Some of you even that have come to Catholic Family Land your whole life, you're in that dark place. Oh, yeah, you come here and you put on the good face and you sing the Mary and you crush Satan's head with your hands, but you're not crushing his head in your heart. You're letting him have reign in your heart and you're believing these lies and you're believing these things that he's speaking to you. You're believing the things that other people tell you. You look in the mirror and what you see are their voices. You do not see yourself as a son or daughter of God. You see yourself as a failure and you see yourself as worthless. And some of you have even thought about suicide. And maybe you've been in that dark place and God's brought you through it. Maybe you're in that dark place now. Maybe that dark place is still coming in your life. The reason why I bring that up, and I'm trying to be really clear about that, is that when you get into that dark place and Satan's lying to you, you have to remember something really, really important. That God is the author of all life. And what is going on right now in your life or in that dark moment that's going on in your life at that dark time is not the end of the story. Amen? Amen. That's not the end of the story, especially now when you're young. You guys can't even imagine. I'm sorry, you can't. You cannot even imagine how much more of your story God wants to write in your life. You have no idea what's coming in your future. When I was your age, if someone had told me that 30 years after I graduated from high school, I was going to be going all over the country talking to teenagers about Jesus and how much God loves them and how much he wants to just love them and help them to be happy and holy, I would have literally mocked you. That would have never, I was like, okay, sure, freaky weirdo. And yet here I am. You know, God had so much more to write in my story, right? You go to the next slide. This is one example, right? I got to college. I went to Franciscan University. That was by the grace of God because I was like, I'll go here, but I want nothing to do with God. I don't even know why I applied there. It's the only school I applied to. And I didn't even live at home. My family lived right across the hill from the campus. I'm like, I'm not living with you. I'm going on campus. And God went, bam, and turned my life like this. And what happened is I had some good friends. And I remember freshman year, I'm there with some of my friends and my one friend, Greg. I was like doing something stupid or fooling around. And he just stopped me. And he said, dude, you don't need to do that. And I said, do what? He's like, you know what I'm saying. You don't have to do that. And I knew what he was saying, but I didn't want to admit it. So I was like, what do you mean? And I tried to act all cool. I was like, what are you talking about, man? And he just looked right at me. And he said, Scott, we like you for you. You don't have to try to be something you're not. Just be you. And honestly, that's the first time I had ever heard that from someone other than my mom. And your mom stops counting at some point. She starts counting again at some point. But like when you're a freshman and your mom's like, well, I think you're handsome. You're kind of like, okay, great. I want the cute girl in my math class to think I'm handsome, right? What am I going to do? Bring you to homecoming? Like that's, what's the comeback when people start ripping on me for bringing my mom to homecoming? Shut up. She drives. I mean, like that you don't have anything there. There's no comeback to that. At some point, you want to know that other people see you and love you and notice you. And this is the first time I get into college, and that started a transformation. But I was still so scared to go back to God. I was like, okay, but I can't really open my whole heart to you, Jesus. And I finally got the courage, and I went to confession for the first time in like 5 years. Oh, I had been in the confessional multiple times on retreats I was made to go to. And I would wear my mask in confession, and I would confess a couple little things so I could get blessed and everybody could say I went to confession. But I really went to confession, and I unloaded, right? I unloaded. And I was so scared because I had taken so many steps away from Jesus that I couldn't even see him anymore. I didn't know where he was. And I started to see him through other people, and they helped lead me back. And I was so scared. I thought, I'm going to go in there and Jesus is going to be like, told you, idiot, that you shouldn't have walked away. Look at all these bad things that happened because you walked away. And Jesus is going to be way far back there. And I was going to have to go so far to get to him, to get back. And you know what I found out? I went into confession. You know where Jesus was the entire time? He was right there. All I did was turn and he was right there. In fact, when I turned, he hit into me because he was chasing after me so fast. He hit into me. And he didn't say, hey, idiot. He just opened up his arms and he said, I've been waiting a long, long time. Welcome home. Welcome home. Sophomore year, I went to school. And yes, I was checking out the freshman girls as they were coming in. And at a pro-life meeting, I spotted one. And we became really good friends doing pro-life ministry, going and getting arrested together and doing all this crazy stuff back in the day. And we fell in love, and then I tricked her into marrying me. And last month in May, well, I guess it's almost last month, but in May we celebrated 25 years of marriage. And if you can go to the next picture, thank you. This was taken at Thanksgiving, you know, and this is my family. We have 8 children on earth, and we have 3 in heaven, right? And I want you to see, like, look at how much of my story God still had to write. Look at that. What if I had done that deed? What if I had taken my own life? Like, what if I had ended my story when it wasn't mine to end? Right? Because here's the other important thing of why I show this picture is because our lives are not our own and our stories are not our own. Look at how many other stories would have not started if I had ended my story. And now I get to go around the country and share my story with other young people. And I have had young people that have come up to me in tears saying, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm in that dark place. I've had kids email or text me or whatever afterwards and say, I was this close to killing myself. I didn't even want to be at that retreat. My parents made me. And God spoke to me through what you said. Another story that was affected by my story. Because I just let God use me. I just turned around and said, yes, God, whatever you want. And what I want to encourage you guys today is that you, one, you know that God loves you. He did not create you because he needed you. He created because he wants you. He is knocking right now on the door of your heart. He is drawing near to you. He wants to come into your heart, and he is the only thing that will ever satisfy your heart. You can look high and low, like St. Augustine, right? But he reminds us, oh God, our hearts were created by you, and they were created for you. And our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And we need to know that. And when God comes into our hearts, guys, that is when we are going to find out happiness. That's where we're going to find out love. That's where we're going to be reminded that we have purpose. That's when we're going to be at peace. Outside of Jesus dwelling in our hearts in a personal, intimate relationship, we are going to constantly be searching our whole lives for happiness, love, purpose, and peace. And we're never going to find it. Never. And God has so much more to write in your story. And there's so much that he's written. And when you go through a dark time, whether it's already been, whether it's right now, whether it's coming, and you can go through dark times when you get older. My life hasn't been perfect since then. My dad died a year and a half ago. It was very painful. My little daughter, Lucy, who just turned 5, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in the fall. And that changed our life around. There's been a lot of suffering in my life that didn't go away just because I opened my heart to Jesus. But now it has purpose. And now it makes sense. And it has meaning. And I can be at peace even when those things happen. That is the life that Jesus is calling you to. A life of surety, a life of peace, ultimately a life of joy, okay? So please know that I'm gonna be really praying for you guys. If later on today I'll be around, because I'm talking to Murad's out later tonight, I'm talking to the college students tomorrow. If anybody wants to, you know, talk later, I'll be here. I have a couple of my kids with me, but they're older, and we'll be around later if anybody wants to talk, or after you do your next activity or whatever, if you want to say hi or whatever, I'll be around until when you're done with that, okay?